Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. This week, President Obama announced he's going to attempt to combat climate change from the Oval Office. Wyoming's three Republicans in Congress are none too happy with his plan. As Matt Laszlo reports, they say it could cripple the state's economy and hit your pocket.
Climate change wasn't really a part of the 2012 election, so the president surprised many when he promised to deal with global warming in his second inaugural address. Now he's coming out swinging again, charging Republicans with being deaf to the scientific community.
97% of scientists, including, by the way, some who originally disputed the data, have now put that to rest. They've acknowledged the planet is warming and human activity is contributing to it.
Wyoming's lawmakers didn't like that jab. I was next to Amy Harder, who covers climate change for National Journal, as she took the president's assertion to Wyoming Senator John Barrasso.
Do you think there needs to be debate about the science of climate change?
The president wants to ignore the economic impacts. We all want to make energy
as... Do you disagree with the science?
We all want to make energy as clean as we can, as fast as we can, and do it in ways that don't raise costs for American families.
Right, but on the science of climate change, do you disagree with what he's saying?
Well, he kind of talked about the flat earth society. You know, we have a very flat economy, and it's because of the president's unwillingness to help us create jobs in this country.
Flat earth or not, Barrasso never answered what side of the climate debate he's on. But Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis thinks it's more helpful to flip the president's proposition on its head.
The science tells us that if China and Russia do nothing, that no matter how much energy we cease to consume, that we cannot affect global warming.
And Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi has his own way of viewing the science.
I've always said that there's $5 billion a year being spent to prove climate change, and there's $5 billion a year being spent to disprove climate change. We ought to take the $10 billion and actually make a difference.
The president says because Congress won't address global warming, he's going to. And he says the Clean Air Act gives him unilateral authority to curb emissions.
And the health and safety of all Americans. I'm directing the Environmental Protection Agency to put an end to the limitless dumping of carbon pollution from our power plants and complete new pollution standards for both new and existing power plants.
Wyoming lawmakers and other Republicans across the U.S. are up in arms over what they say is another executive branch overreach. Wyoming lawmakers, of course, are worried because the president's move promises to pinch producers across the state. The White House hasn't released the exact details of its plan, but the broad outline is something that is sending shivers down the spines of oil and coal executives, the government putting heavy regulations on power plants. Enzi says that's going to squeeze this shaky economy even further.
Everybody ought to be worried about utility prices. The companies don't pay the tax, the consumer does. So their electricity is going to be more expensive, their gasoline is going to be more expensive, their clothes are going to be more expensive. Anything that's manufactured uses energy, and the price of energy is going to go up dramatically.
Enzi says the state isn't sitting pretty in this new scenario.
A lot of revenue comes from the coal, the oil, natural gas, coal bed methane. And those are coals being picked on primarily now, but each of those others will be in their own turn. And that's where a lot of Wyoming's revenue comes from.
But Lummis says it goes deeper than that. She says picking emerging renewable energy sources over traditional fossil fuels will smack the very people the president claims he wants to help.
To hold down poor people by forcing on them the fuel of choice for the American elite is the ultimate in arrogance.
For now, it's a waiting game as the Obama administration crafts the details of its new policy to combat global warming. In the meantime, Wyoming's energy producers and lawmakers are angry, bracing, and trying to figure out what the new world of U.S. energy policy will look like. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Monday, the president of the Wyoming Education Association, Kathy Venerable, joined other colleagues from across the nation and from Wyoming in Atlanta for the National Education Association Representative Assembly, where they'll be discussing a number of education issues. Kathy Vetter joins us to discuss some issues that might be coming up and give us her thoughts on some education issues facing Wyoming. One of those on the agenda surrounds school safety and gun safety prevention.
I look at it as a bigger issue. I think we need to look at the core of what causes students and adults to be violent. And I think the way that we address that is to increase our access to mental health services. Because if we can help the adults and the young people before they become violent with their mental health issues, we will be able to take care of the cause of the problem instead of the symptom of the problem.
I want to also ask you about another issue that will likely come up, and that's dealing with Common Core state standards. I'm just kind of curious how you see things here and maybe what still needs to be, I guess, an issue to be resolved.
The Common Core standards, or the Wyoming Common Core standards, as we call them here, are just a roadmap, a set of standards that we want our students to meet. So what they are clear targets within each of those subject areas that we want our students to strive to meet and hopefully even exceed. But it doesn't tell us what our curriculum will be, what textbooks to use. It's just a roadmap of where we want our students to be when they reach each of those benchmarks.
Are you satisfied with what we've got here?
I do like the Wyoming Common Core standards because I think they are more clearly written than our former standards. These standards have more clear targets for our students to reach, and it's actually easier for an educator when you actually have a clear target of what you want your students to reach, and it makes it easier to plan your lessons, to develop your curriculum when you know where the students need to be.
Kathy Vetter visiting with us. Again, she heads up the Wyoming Education Association. I want to ask you about just some of the reform efforts we've got in the state. Obviously, there's been a lot of tinkering with our education system. You've got accountability issues that are still being worked on. Where are we headed, do you think? And is this positive for teachers and education in general?
Where we're headed and the way we're going with the Accountability Act is positive for our schools, our students, our administrators, and our teachers and education support professionals. We're taking input from all of the different groups with our advisory committee. We're taking it slow. We're looking at the big picture and working our way down to the individual educator by looking at the accountability for a school first, then the school leaders, so that we know that we have excellent leaders in all of our schools, and then down to the classroom with the teachers and ensuring that we're doing everything we can to help our teachers move from good to great so that our students can have a great educational system here in Wyoming.
When this process all started 2 years ago, it struck me that there was a lot of, I guess, animosity towards teachers. Certainly that was my read on that. But I'm curious if you've seen us evolve from that time towards now where maybe it's a much more positive focus on just improving education in general.
You definitely have hit that nail right on the head. It has changed from a negative rhetoric about education and teachers to now a positive message about improving our schools, doing what it takes to make sure that everybody is improving, from our entire schools to our school leaders to our teachers, our paraprofessionals. So I believe that we really have turned the corner and we're working towards improving schools and moving from good to great as opposed to pointing fingers.
Is though, and let me just ask you this as a more of a direct question. If you have somebody who's permanently an education director and they're kind of being a little more consistent with policies, I would think that would be a positive thing for school districts and teachers in general, because you kind of have you don't have a lot of changes depending on an election.
Knowing the direction that we're going and not having that target moved every year or every few years will be very positive. That aligns right with going with a Common Core standard so that we have those targets definitely set. And if our policies become more standard across the state and set, not moving, I think you're right. That could be a positive change for Wyoming.
Kathy Vetter is the president of the Wyoming Education Association. Have a great time in Atlanta.
Thank you, and you have a great day.
When we come back, we'll preview this year's Grand Teton Music Festival. This is Open Spaces. Welcome Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. In July, Wyoming enters the world of adventure racing when the state hosts the Cameco and City of Casper Cowboy Tough Adventure Race. It's a 3.5-day race across the state that begins on July 18th and runs until the 21st. The race covers over 300 miles and involves trekking, mountain biking, road biking, paddling, ropes, and other team challenges. Teams consist of 2 to 4 people who generally get very little sleep. While it includes serious racers, there will also be citizen events. Race director Mike Spiller of Rev 3 Adventure says it is a physically challenging event.
We plan out a small scavenger hunt or a large scavenger hunt where you have different challenges across a region, and your goal is to find different checkpoints, accomplish these challenges, and make it to the finish line in a set period of time.
And I understand this is sort of top secret, but give me a sense of what Wyoming's race is going to look like.
Well, Wyoming being such a large state, what we want to do is highlight all the different regions of the state. So what I can tell you is every year for the next 5 years, we plan on finishing in Casper and starting in a different region. This year's race will start actually in the Cheyenne area, and then from Cheyenne, you'll begin into Casper, and that's where the secrets come into play, is we are designing a 3.5-day race and highlighting a lot of the history within the state and a lot of the recreational areas within the state to get you up to Casper.
So you'll be racing through the recreational areas, perhaps over mountains, things like that?
Yeah, you'll be going through state parks, national forest, bodies of water. So during the race, you will be there'll be a ropes course, so a rappel will come in play, several mountain biking courses, trekking in different regions of the state. And then, like I said, we'll be highlighting history. So there'll be different challenges, and some of those are based on the history of the state, or because it is the Cowboy Tough, it'll be some type of cowboy challenge.
Now, this will be, a 3 or 4 day race?
Yeah, this year and for the next 4 years, it'll be a 3.5-day race. So we lay out a course that an average person can hit the mandatory points in 3.5-day race in that time period, but we'll also be laying out a course that will challenge the elite racers across the world. So they'll come to Wyoming to try to get as many points as possible in 3.5 days. And then in year 5, it'll be a 5 to 7 day race. So it'll be a supported race where we're going to hit all the previous 4 years.
Now, explain this. So you talked about points. There are other events like this going on all the time?
Yeah, this race is actually a national qualifier. There's 3 different governing bodies within the adventure racing community. There's United States Adventure Racing Association, North American Adventure Racing Series, and Checkpoint Tracker. So by anybody racing in this event, they will qualify for all 3 of those national championships.
What kind of training goes into something like this?
Well, there's not really any professional adventure racers. We're all hobbyists and really enjoy the outdoors. So if you want to compete, you know, on the national level, you're spending a lot of time mountain biking, paddling, and running in the mountains or trekking.
Let's talk about a couple of events connected with this. You've got some, first off, the Family Health and Fitness Outdoor Expo.
Yeah, what we wanted to do is when we come in town, it's almost like the circus coming to town. We bring a lot of infrastructure, and our focus has always been getting families active outdoor. So one of the components that comes with us with this type of race weekend is a Family Health and Outdoor Expo. And that'll take place at Mike Lansing Field in Casper, and during the day, there's going to be free clinics on Saturday of the race weekend, where there might be demonstrations on CrossFit, discussions on nutrition, a yoga seminar, something on fly fishing to highlight the outdoors, mountain biking, paddling. So different clinic every half hour starting at noon and going until about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We'll also have exhibitors out there throughout the day so you can learn more about what you can do here within the state of Wyoming. So we'll have some tourist organizations out there. I believe the National Guard will also have an exhibit there at the expo.
You've got some other events that people can participate in?
We have a glow run on Friday night where racers get a shirt that glows in the dark. They get a glow object. Post-race, we'll be playing a movie outdoors, and that's sponsored by the Wyoming Medical Center. On Saturday, we're highlighting the town of Casper through an urban challenge, mini version of Amazing Race, where you have to maybe go to some of the museums and find something, or maybe go down through the rapids at Tate Pump House and go through one set of rapid on the inner tube, one of the 2 or 3 teammates that you have on the team. So it's a series of challenges throughout the city with you and your friends and coworkers to do. And then on Sunday, we have the family adventure race. It's an hour scavenger hunt around Mike Lansing Field where you might have to make a couple shots in the Frisbee golf course, and somebody will be getting wet on that course as well, find a few checkpoints, and once again, a mini version just for the family. So we start with the expedition racers. We have the fun event with the glow race out at night. Saturdays, you and your coworker or teenage kids, and then on Sunday, it's you and the family out experiencing a mini adventure.
Will people get a chance to see any of this, the race events, when the big guys come?
Oh, yeah. That finishes on Sunday. We've timed the finish so that they finish when the family adventure racers cross the finish line as well. As people come out over the weekend, they'll hear about the different activities that are taking place, and we welcome anybody to come down and watch the finish. These people have been racing for 3.5 days, and the final leg of their race is they're going down through the rapids at Tate's Pump House on kickboards, and then they have to make it the last mile and a half to the finish line carrying their kickboards and crossing after 3.5 days of racing. So the family racers will be finishing at the same time, and our plan is to have a big outdoor cowboy cookout for both the family adventure racers and the expedition racers at that time.
Rev3adventure.com is where people can learn more about this?
That's correct. Or you can go to Google and type in Cowboy Tough Adventure Race, and we'll be the first thing that pops up for you.
Mike Spiller, a pleasure. Thank you for coming in.
Great. Thanks for your time.
Next week, the annual Grand Teton Music Festival gets underway at the Walk Festival Hall in Teton Village. Andrew Palmer Todd is the new executive director of the event. He says it's become very well known.
We have an excellent acclaimed conductor and music director in Donald Runicles, who's not just conducting here, but he's fresh off an international trip with the Philadelphia Orchestra in China, which was a much heralded event. He's also at the Berlin Staatsoper, and he's a principal guest conductor in Atlanta. And so he's just one piece of how nationally and internationally respected the festival is. And what people don't always realize, we have about 250 orchestral musicians who cycle through here for the seven-week season between July 5th, which is the first festival performance, and August 17th. And they come from a range of orchestras: San Francisco, Philadelphia, Houston, Naples Philharmonic, Chicago Symphony, on and on it goes. But it's really an impressive collection of orchestral musicians and a music director who's really at the pinnacle of his career.
I think the thing that maybe people don't totally get, and I didn't get it until I was up there, is, as you mentioned, they come from big orchestras, but a lot of them are very big names, both younger and older, up-and-coming stars, and they see this as a great opportunity to come to Jackson Hole and just kind of relax and play a little music. But these are very big names many times.
I'll take Gail Williams, who's our principal hornist, who's one, if not the finest hornist in the country, and she's retired from Chicago Symphony and doing a lot of chamber music. And one of the reasons she's been coming here for years is it's a disciplined rehearsal schedule and two excellent concerts on Friday and Saturday night every week. And really talented musicians are committed to the artistic process, and we provide that for them. It's a very serious adventure for them here. And that's really what attracts them coming back year after year.
Visiting with Andrew Palmer Todd, he's the executive director of the Grand Teton Music Festival, and of course events get underway here shortly. What's going to be some of the music we'll be hearing this summer?
A full range of classical favorites, some very well known, some lesser known, but we kick off the season with the program July 5th and 6th, which is going to feature young cellist Elisa Weilerstein performing the Elgar Cello Concerto, just a beloved work from the early 1920s. And we also have a tradition of kicking off the season with the Beethoven Symphony. So we have a very sunny Beethoven 4th Symphony, which is in the second half. But it's a big Verdi year. It's an anniversary year for Verdi. So we've got the Verdi Requiem on July 26th and 27th. And then wrapping up the season with an old Tchaikovsky concert featuring the pianist Yefim Bronfman. But there's also myriad chamber music concerts on Tuesday nights and Thursday nights. And we also present non-classical music on Wednesday nights throughout the summer.
Do you have some other special artists that will be coming in during the summer?
Yes, James Ennis, who's a young Canadian violinist, is terrific and just a real up-and-comer whose star is very bright. And he's doing a Mozart concerto, which will be terrific, and it's coupled with a Mahler symphony in the second half. And we also have a guitarist, which I'm looking forward to hearing, whom I've not yet had the pleasure of hearing, and his name is Pablo Sanz Villegas. And he's doing the Rodrigo Concierto de Aranjuez. And it's one of these pieces, when I try to introduce them to classical music, I say, this is a piece you know. You know it from cinema. You know it from TV commercials. And so when you go and enjoy this piece, it won't be the first time you hear it, even if you think it's going to be.
One of the things that might be worth mentioning, just since we're hitting the 4th of July, you mentioned just that first weekend of the 5th, but specifically the music in the hole in the 4th, what's that entail?
Great patriotic day, and the Festival Orchestra will perform at 6 p.m., and I want to encourage folks, if they can't make it, to tune into Wyoming Public Radio, which will be broadcasting it live, and will also be on Wyoming PBS, and this is the first time we've broadcast it statewide, which we're very excited about. But that concert will have the usual favorites. It'll be the 1812 Overture, the National Anthem, and we always like to think of it as the worst-kept encore secret in concerts, which is Stars and Stripes Forever.
I know you have plenty of people up there that try and hit as many of these concerts as possible, but for folks around the state, if they want to check out online and get ticket information, how can they go about doing that?
GTMF.org is the simplest way to check out the whole season and hopefully purchase tickets. And we really are encouraging people to come and enjoy great music in an acoustically superb hall and really just be open to that experience of being in a concert hall for an hour and a half. Whether you're a classical music aficionado or you just love great music, we want to make sure that that experience is first rate.
And it's a great venue, the Walk Festival Hall. I know people will enjoy going there again. Everything gets underway next week. Get Music in the Hole on the 4th, and then things kick off the weekend of the 5th all the way through August 17th. It's the 52nd summer season. Andrew Palmer Todd, the executive director, we wish you well with your new position, and thank you for joining us on Open Spaces.
Well, thank you. Am I allowed to encourage people to pledge at the end of a fiscal year campaign? I just feel so duty-bound to tell people that I ran a public radio station, I joined this week, and I'm encouraging others to join me.
Well, we appreciate that support, Andrew, and again, have a great summer.
You too. Thank you, Bob.
When we come back, we'll hear about efforts to save the Ogallala Aquifer, and we'll take a look at gambling addiction in Fremont County. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. A small corner of southeast Wyoming sits over the Ogallala Aquifer. The Ogallala is a huge aquifer that stretches from Wyoming and Nebraska all the way to Texas. It is a key source of water for agriculture, but it's being depleted faster than it can recharge. So the Natural Resources Conservation Service is trying to help save it. Here in Wyoming, they're doing that by encouraging farmers to give up their water rights. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
It's not clear how long it will take before the water in the Ogallala runs out. There's a lot that scientists don't understand about how aquifers work, and unpredictable factors like weather come into play. But it is clear that the current rate of water consumption is unsustainable. State Engineer Pat Terrell says Laramie County monitoring wells indicate that water levels have dropped a foot or two per year over the past few decades, and he says that's worrisome.
Tens of feet in an aquifer that may be 100, 200 feet in total thickness is important, so we are concerned about that aquifer.
In parts of Texas, the aquifer has already been depleted so much that irrigated agriculture is impossible. The Natural Resources Conservation Service is trying to keep that from happening elsewhere. Jim Pike is in charge of the effort in Wyoming. He's targeting farmers because they typically use a lot of water for irrigation.
I'm offering a payment for them to give up, basically give up their water allocation, for the greater good.
In other words, Pike is trying to convince farmers to give up their water rights forever. In exchange, he offers a financial incentive. Mike Polma is one farmer who agreed to Pike's proposal. Polma's farm sits on a flat, open plain near Carpenter. 3 years ago, he abandoned his wells and switched to dryland farming. That means he now relies solely on rainwater. As we drive around the property, Polma points out the shriveled brown remnants of a failed crop.
This is what was dried up and became dry land. And that was millet, and you can see how it just didn't grow and it burned up.
Polma says without water, he can't grow as much. In fact, last year, he didn't harvest anything. But then again, his harvests had not been good for a while. That's because in recent years, his wells had been drying up.
I didn't have any water, period, you know, or not much, so it was borderline whether it was worth turning on the wells.
Because his wells were in such bad shape, Polma says it made sense to sign on to the NRCS program and give up his water rights. The NRCS has been paying him $35,000 a year, which helped make up for the lost crops and got him out of debt. The payments end after 3 years, but he says he's not worried about the future.
I'm 60 years old and all my debts are paid off, so I don't have to make nearly as much as I used to.
But in many cases, getting farmers to abandon their wells has been a tough sell. Irrigated land can produce at least twice as much, and in some cases 10 times as much as dry land. So if you switch to dry land, you have far fewer crops to sell. That's why hay producer Todd Fornstrom decided not to participate in the NRCS program.
I guess what I would say is it would be a way to get out of farming in kind of a step-by-step process and work kind of in the expansion mode or maintenance mode rather than trying to get out of farming.
Plus, property values drop if the land has no water rights. Still, experts say abandoning wells doesn't involve as big a financial hit as you might think. Danelle Peck is an ag economist at the University of Wyoming. She says, sure, switching to dry land reduces productivity, but your electricity costs also go way down because you don't have to pump water.
So there's a little bit of a trade-off. Lower yields, but also lower costs.
So far, the NRCS has convinced producers in Laramie County to stop irrigating 2,000 acres of farmland, which is saving 1 billion gallons of water a year.
2,000 acres, not large scale, quite honestly.
That's David Brower with the USDA's Agricultural Research Service in Texas. He says based on their experiences, meaningful water conservation only happens under two circumstances.
One, there's large-scale buy-in. Second, there's some sort of regulation and policy put in place, either by a water district or whatever, that limits the amount that's pumped.
But Jim Pike says they have to start somewhere.
It's a step in the right direction. But we need to do more. We haven't solved the problem here by any means.
Pike says if they can double the amount of acreage that's taken out of irrigation in Laramie County, it could start to make a noticeable difference. Brower says it's still probably just buying time. Still, he says buying time is worthwhile. He says if the aquifer is depleted more slowly, it will give scientists and the ag community time to come up with ways to deal with the dwindling water supply, whether that means pumping water from the East Coast or modifying crops to need less water or just learning how to farm on dry land more efficiently. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
There have been rumors that Fremont County is experiencing a rise in gambling addiction amongst its residents. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov reports that whether the rumors are true or not is still unclear, but some services are popping up to address it regardless.
The Wind River Hotel and Casino in Riverton is full of chirping slot machines, game tables, bright lights, and gamblers. There are different opinions regarding how much good gaming has brought to the county and tribes, but there is also concern about gambling addictions.
In 2006 is when I probably started gambling compulsively.
That's a compulsive gambler in recovery we'll call Anna, who did not want her real name used.
Started out just like everyone else, going out with $20. Went out with my friend, we would have dinner, play a little bit, laugh and joke, and it was all fun. It continued to be fun for a while, and then the amount of money we put in went up, and then it just got out of hand.
Anna declined to share the details of her story, except to say that it got real bad. We met at a Gamblers Anonymous meeting in a church located just a couple minutes' drive from the big casino. Only two of the five regulars attended that particular meeting, one of whom was the organizer, who also didn't want her name used. She started the meetings when a friend sought help and found no resources in the community. She got in touch with the International Gamblers Anonymous office, found the space for the meetings, and bought materials out of pocket.
Gambling isn't spoke of. Nobody talks about it. You know, even with all the casinos we have in Fremont County, nobody talks about gambling and people losing their houses, losing everything they own. It happens all the time.
The organizer and Anna are both clear that it's not the casino's fault, but they say that gambling addiction is still very much a problem. There are no statistics about whether the number of gambling addicts is increasing. Here's Fremont County prosecuting attorney Brian Varn.
I don't know that I can say that it's been an increase for certain. I know that in the last 4 years, we've had around 8 cases in which the defendants themselves told us that the reason they had been involved in embezzlement and theft from their employers was because of their gambling.
He suspects other cases were also linked to gambling, but he can't be sure. Varn says those numbers aren't exactly an epidemic, and the Gamblers Anonymous meetings aren't overflowing either. But the National Council of Problem Gambling estimates that there are 8,000 problem gamblers and 4,000 pathological gamblers in Wyoming. Executive Director of the Council, Keith White, says nobody actually counts, so the numbers could be higher. In the past 6 months, the council's hotline received an average of 50 calls a month from Wyoming. White says part of the problem is that gambling is legal, and gambling addiction isn't often seen as an illness.
Until recently, it hasn't been seen as also a public health problem. The state has been very slow to address it and respond to it, just like other diseases like diabetes or drug abuse or depression, although we see them and the medical community sees them as all very similarly related.
The Fremont County Counseling Service is one entity that is taking the issue seriously, despite the lack of data. They're starting a gambling awareness group that will teach classes about signs and symptoms of gambling addiction, what to look out for, and how to engage someone who may be a problem gambler. So far, demand for the class has been low. For now, though, Director of Fremont Counseling Service, Jerry McAdams, says the class is still worth holding.
Need and demand are two different things. I'm not opposed to doing things that when I know there's a need, but then at some point in time, we have to catch up the need and the demand together where we can run a viable program.
The Wind River Casino recognizes there is a problem, too. The casino's Andrea Clifford says they've seen it affect their employees. The casino has brought in specialists to train all staff on problem gambling awareness and train local counselors to specialize in gambling addiction. They also provide self-exclusion, where people self-identify themselves and are asked to leave the casino if found there. But the organizer and Anna both said it doesn't work. Finally, the casino used to help out with GA meetings in the past. Currently, however, Clifford says casino staff is stretched thin, and it doesn't help that there aren't other resources in the area.
It was kind of hard for us because when we called the National Hotline for Problem Gambling, they didn't even realize that Wyoming had casinos here. So, you know, we were kind of like, yeah, we're here, we've been here, and we need some services and some help.
Current GA meetings convene at the Church of Christ in Riverton every Monday at 6 p.m. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
Wyoming has one of the highest rates of suicide in the country, nearly twice the national average. Until recently, efforts at preventing suicide were left up to individual counties. But now, the state is trying a new tactic, which they hope will save more lives. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
Danielle was 14 when she tried to kill herself. Her real name isn't Danielle, but she wanted to remain anonymous for this story. As a teen, she felt extremely isolated. Her parents and siblings rarely spent time together, and when they did, they often fought. Her relationship with her mother was especially difficult.
She would ask me, "Are you okay today?" But her response when I'd say, "No, I had a bad day," wasn't to be sympathetic and listen, even if she didn't want to. It was always of aggravation and frustration, almost like, "I know that you're having a hard time, but so am I."
Things came to a head one day when Danielle's mother refused to let her visit her boyfriend.
And I got so mad that the only thing I could think to do is go in my room and try to down a bottle of Tylenol.
Danielle ended up being fine, but she says her suicide attempt was very hard on the family, and she says it probably could have been averted.
One of the best things that people can do is just be educated on the signs of people who are likely to hurt themselves, because I was definitely exhibiting them, as were many of my friends, and nobody stopped any of them. Nobody even mentioned anything.
Educating people about warning signs is a cornerstone of Wyoming's new effort at suicide prevention. What they're trying to do is institute a uniform prevention effort across the whole state. To implement that, the health department has hired regional suicide prevention coordinators who will work with mental health professionals and others in each community on suicide prevention. The initiative is being headed up by Teresa Humphreys Wadsworth, who's the state suicide prevention coordinator. She says in the past, they treated suicide as a series of isolated events. Now, they're treating it as a statewide public health problem.
Suicide is the second leading cause of death for our young people. If we suddenly had a flu that was the second leading cause of death, people would be up in their arms and doing everything they could to prevent that flu. Well, suicide is preventable.
Humphreys Wadsworth and her colleagues are conducting training sessions across the state for teachers, school administrators, and everyday citizens. They're explaining how to recognize warning signs and what to do if you see them. They're even testing out an online training program for healthcare providers.
When someone doesn't walk in the door and say, "I'm suicidal, doc, I need help," honestly, they don't come in with that message. They come in with, "I can't sleep," or "I'm in terrible pain," or I've lost all my energy.
Most agree that Wyoming's high suicide rate is partly a result of cultural norms. Keith Hodel heads the suicide prevention effort at the Wyoming Department of Health. He says many Wyomingites, especially men, don't seek help if they're in distress because they've been raised with the idea that they should cowboy up and handle their problems themselves.
The flip side of that is so much of our state is rural and people know each other. And so if you live in Lusk, Wyoming, and your pickup truck is parked in front of the mental health center, folks are going to know.
Hodel says they hope to chip away at the stigma of asking for help. They especially want to reach out to middle-aged men who have the highest suicide rate. One TV ad they're running in Park County shows a man standing in a gas station convenience store.
Surrounded by strangers. I've never felt so isolated. So alone.
Can anyone hear me? Anyone?
The ad ends with a number for a 24/7 depression hotline. Hodel says in addition to trying to get people help, they also want to keep suicidal individuals away from weapons. Two-thirds of suicides in Wyoming are by firearm, and Hodel says friends, family members, and even firearm retailers need to watch out for signs that someone might be in crisis and then take away their gun until they're in a better mindset.
It's like, friends, don't let friends drive drunk. You know, don't give somebody the keys to a highly lethal vehicle traveling at God only knows what speed. And so it's kind of the same thing.
So will Wyoming's approach actually result in fewer suicides? Bob Gebbia with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention says the state's strategy sounds like a good one, but it's hard to know for sure.
There isn't a lot of study of this, and therefore we don't have as many, you know, evidence-based interventions and strategies. I wish we did.
Gebbia adds that getting people to accept help is only part of the equation. Help also has to be available, and Wyoming, like many rural areas, has too few mental health professionals. But the state suicide prevention team says they have a plan for that, too. They hope to train rural medical providers to offer mental health care, which would make mental health expertise available in more remote areas of the state. And they're optimistic that within a few years, there will be a noticeable decline in suicides. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
When we come back, I'll try to explain the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund. Stay tuned. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. Frequently during the legislative session, you'll hear lawmakers refer to Wyoming's Permanent Mineral Trust Fund. The fund was established in 1974 by then Governor Stan Hathaway and is funded by a portion of severance taxes or taxes paid by the energy industry and occasional money deposited by the legislature. Income from the fund can be used to pay for government. It has a market value of roughly $5.6 billion. It's viewed as a key part of Wyoming's funding future. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
Treasurer Mark Gordon says the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund, or the PMTF as the cool kids call it, accounts for the second most significant source of revenue for the state behind severance taxes.
What's become clear to me in the last several years, you sort of have moved past the notion of this is a good savings plan for the state to this is a significant revenue generator for the state to this has a responsibility for the state's future.
House Majority Floor Leader Kermit Brown says legislators spend about $130 million of income from the fund. He says the PMTF is what makes it possible for the state to manage without an income tax.
Take that $130 million and divide it by the number of people who are working in the state, and that would be the amount of the state income tax. And I'll tell you, it would be a substantial number that our citizens would have to pay to have the goods and services and benefits that we have right now without the income stream from that permanent mineral trust fund.
The way the fund grows, of course, is by putting money into it. Senate Appropriations Chairman Eli Bebout says lawmakers need to put even more money into the fund.
You know, in the tough times we had in the 90s, that accounted for about 25% of our revenues for the general fund. That has gone down to as low as 15% in the last 4 or 5 years. We need to get that back up to 25%.
Lawmakers have been doing that by dropping a few million dollars here and there into the fund, even in years when state agencies are facing budget cuts. Senator Cale Case stresses the reason you want to do that is because the fund may become critical in the future if revenue from the energy industry drops.
How do we have future revenues in minerals? Well, you keep supporting your permanent funds as long as you can. So that when that crossover point occurs where current revenues are less than current needs, you can fall back on the earnings of the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund.
But when budgets are tight, some say the legislature should put less money into the fund. For instance, Governor Mead proposed taking some of the money that was to go into the PMTF and put it into a legislative reserve account where the money could be used more easily. Senator Stan Cooper wanted to use some of that money for highways. Floor Leader Kermit Brown says that type of conversation always picks up when budgets are tight.
They see a need, and they say there's a need there and there's all this money, and I can't reconcile having all this money coexist with the needs. Why aren't the needs being addressed with that kind of money? And it takes a longer view of things, I think, to understand and put those two opposing views in perspective.
Treasurer Mark Gordon says that long view is important.
If we are to sort of pull monies out of it and think that we have a rainy day, that will compromise our long-term future.
But while the PMTF has generated some significant revenue in recent years, lawmakers have been inclined to save a lot of that money for a rainy day instead of spending it. But House Minority Floor Leader Mary Throne says that's the wrong approach. There is no way, she says, that the state should be considering budget cuts when the PMTF is generating millions of dollars. She argues that revenues from the fund should be used.
You can't say we have to build up the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund so it generates revenue. And then once it generates revenue, we can't use the revenue from the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund.
Throne's concern is that the legislature is putting a lot of PMTF revenue into the legislative savings accounts instead of using it for necessary projects and things such as state employee raises. Senate Appropriations Chairman Eli Bebout says setting aside the revenue from the PMTF is part of the package as lawmakers plan for a future where energy revenues could be a lot less. He says they're being proactive with an eye to the future.
In our occasional series, Upstarts, we profile Wyoming entrepreneurs. There's no shortage of self-starters in this state, many of whom build, grow, or make things. But until recently, tech startups were almost unheard of in the cowboy state. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez visited with Jason Kinsler, who founded the Pitch Engine software platform in his native Lander and authored the book The New American Startup. She filed this report.
Like many successful entrepreneurs, Jason Kinsler saw a need and came up with a marketable solution. In his case, the problem was marketing in the age of social media. Kinsler says companies were using antiquated tools like Word documents and email to update media outlets and potential customers about what they were up to, but it was cumbersome.
And so I came up with this idea to package it all together and share it as a link.
In other words, each pitch a company sends out is a promotional package that can include photos, videos, relevant links, and it can be easily shared on social media sites.
We've evolved into this publishing platform, not unlike what Microsoft did in publishing for small businesses back in the 90s. You know, all of a sudden businesses could make their own flyers or, create a poster. We're sort of doing that for the web and mobile, and it's caught on.
The Pitch Engine office is certainly cool-looking enough to rival any Silicon Valley headquarters. The bright storefront on Landers Main Street has a hip, minimalist design with bright furniture, exposed wood beams, and shag carpet. The cubicles have sliding stable doors. Wearing a T-shirt, work pants, and a 5 o'clock shadow, Kinsler fits in well among the laid-back staff. It's his kind of workplace.
I'm a Wyoming kid. I was born in Lander and grew up in Wyoming. And for me, it was about trying to figure out how to stay here, not trying to figure out how to get out.
Kinsler started out in journalism as a news anchor in Billings before transitioning into a public relations job in Riverton.
As a 20-something PR guy at the time, I was online doing things with social media sites like MySpace at the time or Facebook, and I could do all this cool stuff, but as a business, as a professional, I couldn't do it. And so I came up with this idea to build Pitch Engine.
Kinsler started working on Pitch Engine on nights and weekends in 2008 and outsourced a web developer. He made sure the company could pay for itself from the start and didn't hire himself until months after the company was founded. He blogged about the challenges of brands gaining media attention and marketed Pitch Engine on social networking sites. And it worked.
I made a product for public relations pros and communicators. So when they see something cool, they share it and they talk about it. And that's sort of how it went viral.
Colorado-based Backbone Media was one of the first companies to use Pitch Engine. Backbone handles the marketing for outdoor brands, including Eddie Bauer and Smartwool, and destinations that include the Sun Valley and Telluride ski resorts. Ian Anderson is the public relations director for Backbone Media, and he says Pitch Engine has become invaluable for distributing press releases.
The traditional press release was essentially just a Word document, pretty uninspiring and not dynamic or interactive in any way.
For instance, Backbone recently released a pitch about the GoPro camera company signing on as a sponsor for the Summer Mountain Games in Vail.
What Pitch Engine allowed us to do was embed a video from GoPro with footage from the event straight into the release, as well as links to the destination. We can talk about the competitions, the concerts, etc. And then we added photos, and then it has all the shareable options, so it can be easily tweeted, posted to Facebook, added to Instagram, etc.
But Pitch Engine offers a range of costs and services which help smaller businesses to market their brands. Paula McCormick handles marketing for the Wind River Visitors Council in Lander. McCormick says using Pitch Engine makes it easier to compete for the attention of tourists, but the platform also allows her to improve the Wind River Visitors Council's visibility on search engines and to track the exposure of each pitch.
Well, I certainly think that it helps level the playing field for those of us who are maybe in remote areas or certainly have smaller budgets. And when we can get our information out and get that increased exposure, I do think it helps level the playing field.
Now more than 45,000 companies use Pitch Engine to market their brands. Kinsler has already turned down a $9 million acquisition offer for the company. Even from Tiny Lander, Pitch Engine is a success. But the challenges of running his tech business in Wyoming haven't gone away. They've just changed over time.
When we're first starting out, we find that, you know, there's not a lot of legal support for an internet startup. You go to a bank and they don't understand that you don't have these assets that they can count. It's hard to get your arms around in Wyoming because we're just not used to that.
But Kinsler says the state is trying. He has Governor Matt Mead's ear when it comes to growing Wyoming's tech industry, a major priority for the administration.
As we grow, obviously finding employees is a difficult thing. We've managed to bring in employees from Chicago and Texas and places like that, and we're up to 12 employees now, and that's pretty exciting, but it is difficult.
Kinsler says the people he hires don't necessarily come ready with the skills. Still, he has plans to expand the business in the state, and he says Pitch Engine might open a satellite office elsewhere someday, but he thinks small tech startups will continue to pop up in places far from Silicon Valley. Kinsler says technology has made it so location is no longer important, but Lander suits him just fine. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.